Church, I invite you to take your copy of God's Word, take your Bible and open it to the Gospel of Mark. Gospel of Mark. We are in chapter 7. Chapter 7. In fact, we will end chapter 7 today. We've been working through that chapter over the past few weeks, and we continue our study right where we left off in this chapter in Gospel of Mark from last week. Remember last week, we saw Jesus leave Galilee, and he was penetrating deep into Gentile territory, Tyre and Sidon, that region that is north and west of Galilee. We saw that. We began that last week. The Gospel of Matthew, actually, we're in Mark. The Gospel of Matthew also tells the story of that Gentile woman that we looked at last week. Same story in Matthew. We talk about gospel harmony. And in fact, her faith is commended there, same story that we looked at, but it goes on to say this very generally. Let me just read you the account right after the Syrophoenician woman in Matthew. It says this in Matthew 15, 29, 31. Jesus went on from there and walked beside the Sea of Galilee, and he went on the mountain and sat down there, and great crowds came to him, bringing with them the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others. And they put them at his feet, and he healed them. So that the crowd wondered when they saw the mute speaking, the crippled healthy, the lame walking, and the blind seeing. And they glorified the God of Israel. When you hear that, you probably might think that's a very broad view, isn't it? It's one of those passages, it's a very broad, overarching view of the ministry of Jesus this time. Lots of activity summarized there, right? A very general account in Matthew for this moment. Very similar to the ending of John 20, right? When John says, Jesus did many other signs and they're not written in this book. It's one of those accounts where so much of Christ, you feel, is summarized into just one or two lines. That's our general connection in Matthew, and it's what connects us to the next account in the life of Jesus, which will be the feeding of the 4,000. We're going to get there next week. That's where Matthew goes. That's where we're going next week. However, the connection in the Gospel of Mark is very different. It is not a general summary connecting the Syrophoenician woman and the feeding of the 4,000. Not general at all. In fact, let's read what comes next in the Gospel of Mark, before the feeding of the 4,000 and right after our passage last week. Let's pick it up in verse 31. Then he, Jesus, returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee in the region of the Decapolis. And they brought to him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment, and they begged him to lay his hand on him. And taking him aside from the crowd privately, he put his fingers into his ears, and after spitting, touched his tongue. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, Ephphatha, that is, be opened. And his ears were opened, his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. And Jesus charged them to tell no one. But the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, he has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. So we've become accustomed to, in the Gospel of Mark, this gospel draws us close, does it not, to Jesus? This is the gospel really bringing us in tight to Christ. We get up close, eyewitness, intimate details of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. That's right from chapter 1, verse 1. Mark brings us close. And it is absolutely no different with the account open before us today. Do you see that? The general account that you might receive in another gospel, but here in Mark, Mark just pulls us right in beside Christ. Mark pauses to share this special encounter with Jesus by this man. And it is the only gospel that does so. This is the only gospel where we get this intimate account of Jesus. And at first glance, we may indeed be tempted to want to generally fly by. Maybe you're sitting there this morning as you read that, and you may be tempted to say, well, we could have done a general flyby because so much sounds familiar, does it not? So much in this account seems like we've been there before. A Gentile in need, a healing from Jesus, and even more, an instruction to say nothing. We might think this morning, what more is there to say? Are you just telling us more of what we already know, Mark? Far from that, this gospel account is drawing us closer to Christ. Not just another look at Christ, but a closer look at a close Christ. That's the point of this passage. In fact, Mark very intentionally takes us to an account that puts the closeness of Christ, mark this, the intimacy of Christ, on brilliant display. That's what he's doing here, very intentionally. This passage, friends, is simply rich with detail that we don't want to miss. And church, I would suggest to you, when it comes to intimacy like this, we can't miss this. We're living in a world, are we not? So much has been said, so I'm not going to belabor the point. We are living in a very impersonal world, is it not true? You know, that it is the grand paradox, is it not? The shrinking global village. You can talk to someone across the world in seconds, yet we have never been farther apart. People have never felt more alone. We have absolutely lost intimacy with each other. Indeed, it is a grand contradiction of the age. And friends, as we think about that, people lost behind screens of all kinds that fit in the palm of your hand, that fill up a whole wall. As we're lost behind those screens, our heart aches for intimacy. It begs to draw close to someone. Close contact is so void today that when it does happen, have you been here? When it does happen, when intimacy does show up in your life, it can feel so stark, can't it? When you have that moment of intimacy with someone, it feels so arresting. Where did that come from? The parent that enters the closed bedroom, to the son, to the daughter that is surprised. The friend that shows up at the door, the friend willing to stay late hours of the night, the held hand, and even these days, what's shocking? The phone call. We're even surprised when someone calls us. That's the order of the day. It can seem so foreign. Intimacy seems so foreign in a world that is completely devoid of closeness. And all the while, our hearts ache and ache and ache for someone to draw near to us. And not just to draw near, but to draw near with purpose, with intent, and mark it with understanding. Understanding of what we truly need, because friends, all of us know this. We are in great need. We are in great need. And here in this last passage that you have open in front of you in Mark 7, we find that need fulfilled. And far, far from just another healing, this passage meets our soul in a way that no one else can. We need to begin our look at this intimate Christ. So let's dig in with our first point. Christ draws close to where we are. Christ draws close to where we are. First verse, look again with me at verse 31. Then he returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee in the region of the Decapolis. Once again, friends, as we track the geography of Jesus, it's just so important to get an understanding of what Jesus is doing here. So with that in mind, we will look one last time at this map of the region because it's just so important to understand what Jesus is doing. Last week, remember, if you look up at the map, we talked about Jesus being in Tyre and Sidon. Tyre, look at way up at the top, is on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. Jesus is there. Sidon is about 20 miles north of Tyre. It's not even on the map. That's the region that Jesus was in with the Syrophoenician woman, modern-day Lebanon, if you will. And consider where Jesus is going. I want you to look, as you see that map, and you think we're getting very familiar, I hope we are now with the geography, look at the end of verse 31, where Jesus is going. Where is that? That's the Decapolis. Do you see that in your Bible? Now look back on the map, you see that the Decapolis is. That's the region. Decapolis literally means Deca, plus 10 cities, the region of 10 cities. That's what Decapolis means. It's on the southeastern side of Galilee. So you see that? You are on one region up top, and then you have to go south to get to the Decapolis. That, of course, that region that you see there on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee, we got familiar with in chapter 5, did we not, with the demoniac? Remember that brief encounter by Jesus crossing in the boat for that special date in that barren land with that demon-possessed man? So we know this region, and this verse tells us that Jesus is headed to that region again. Now, fair enough. I want you to look at that map, and I want you to consider the route that you would take if you were going from Tyre to Decapolis. Now, we won't spend a lot of time with that, but many of you, especially those that love their trusty GPS, can come up with real good short distances to get from Tyre to Decapolis, right? And I can tell you this, no matter what route your internal GPS tells you, there's one thing all of those routes would have in common, and what's that? You would go south. However, once again, we'll see that our ways are not his ways. Look at verse 31. Jesus went through Sidon. Now, before we leave our map, I want you to look at it one last time. Consider that Sidon, if you look up at the map, you see where Tyre is. It's 20 miles north of Sidon, of Tyre. That's where Sidon is. And to grasp the route here, it'd be like if I was telling you, I'm going to Coburg. And to get to Coburg from Peterborough, I'm just going to go through Bridge North to get to Coburg. Well, that's exactly what Jesus is doing here. Right, to get there, he's going here. Exact same thing. Doesn't make sense geographically. In fact, it's counterintuitive, isn't it? Yet it's exactly what Jesus does here. He heads north to head south. Even more confounding, and mark this, is the trajectory of Jesus' movements now. In other words, the way, there's a manner in which Jesus is going about things now. I mean, remember, all the way back to chapter 3. Do you remember this in chapter 3? Jesus' movements here, the great crowd. Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the sea, and a great crowd followed from Galilee and Judea. Look at all these parts on the map as we say this. Jerusalem, Idumea, from beyond the Jordan, and from around Tyre and Sidon. Great crowds hearing all that he's doing, and they come to him. Great crowds, that entire scope of the map, that whole region, coming to Jesus. And what happened from there? His popularity increased, more fame, more renowned. And generally, what do we think in our thinking? More popularity equals what? Less effort, right? The more popular one is, the less they have to work for it. Well, I was talking to a musician a while ago, talking about the grassroots effort that's needed. When you're a musician and you're just starting out, you have to work for it. You're not very popular, you're not very well known, and you gotta go out and you gotta get it. You gotta go around, make sure that people know who you are, you work hard, you get in the bus, you do the thing, and you're going out, because that's what you do as a young, unknown musician. You gotta work. But then, maybe, you start to get known, and popularity increases, and what starts to happen? Rather than you going out, what happens? People come to you. They want you to be somewhere, do something. You don't have to work as hard. So the idea is that once you're popular and established, people come to you. Now I want you to consider Jesus' life. His name is spread. He is known. And does Jesus just pitch the tent and have the people come? Does he just sit in the chair and the people come to Jesus? No. Instead, what does he do? He goes. It's when Jesus is known, his name is revealed, that that is the time that he starts going. And not just going, but coming, drawing near to people all over and to exactly where he's needed. And where is that? Regions like Tyre and Sidon and the Decapolis region that we read about today. Dark Gentile regions, unclean, ungodly places to the Jews then. We talked about that last week. Yet that is precisely where Jesus goes. And not just there, but remember the route. He heads north. He penetrates deep. He goes to those places, right? Heads up deep into Gentile territory. Jesus pushes up further and draws closer to where the need is. Do you see that? Into places that you would never expect, especially with where Jesus is in his ministry and his name so well known. I'm reminded of Acts 18, Paul's second missionary journey. Lands in Corinth. The church is birthed in Corinth. And what does Jesus say to him about staying there? I have many people in this city that are mine. And what does Paul do in that pagan, evil city? He stays there 1.5 years. Same idea, Jesus, God pushing into areas that we would least expect. And friends, it should be no surprise to us, after last week, we noted how Jesus didn't just enter Tyre, Gentile land, but what did he do when he entered Tyre? He entered a house. That's pushing up and pushing in, deep into Gentile land. Heading into that house where that woman was, Christ coming to her, Christ finding her. It's not just the ministry of Christ, but listen, friends, that's the plan of God. God coming. That's the way it's been from the very beginning. Listen to Ephesians 1, chapter 1, verse 4. He chose us in him before the foundation of the world. Who is initiating the action there? God is. God choosing. God coming down. God coming to you. That's God's action coming. That's the heart of God. It's always been his plan. And it's that same heart of God, Christians, that pursued that desperate woman in Tyre. It's come back here now, that heart of God, that God-man has come to this Decapolis here for another in need, this deaf and mute man. Same heart, as we need to say as we begin this morning, that pursued you, to find you where you were. That's Christ drawing close, no matter how far in you are, that is Christ pursuing you, pursuing her, and pursuing him. So that's our first point. Our second, Christ draws close to what we are. Christ draws close to where we are. We can speak about location and now what we are. Jesus arrives in the Decapolis, right? And remember, we've talked about that already. Last time there, remember one of the things about the Decapolis, especially when Jesus arrived there, remember how barren it was? There was no one there. And remember how Jesus sent the demoniac away. Do you remember that? He healed the demoniac. It was quite a scene. And then this happens in verse 19 of chapter 5. He did not permit him. Remember, the demoniac wanted to stay with him. Jesus didn't permit him, but said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he's had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. And everyone marveled. He went away into the Decapolis and began to proclaim the Lord's mercy. Do you see that? Very clear. Well, mission accomplished. Jesus no longer an unknown entity in that barren Decapolis, at least on the shore. And as a result, verse 32, look at verse 32. They brought to him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment. Jesus now, right, comes back to the region and the people immediately identify him. Where he identified that demoniac before. So you can see he is known now in the Decapolis. A similar scene plays out here in the Gentile land as we've seen before in Galilee. Have we not seen this before in Galilee? Remember back in chapter 2, do you remember the paralytic? What did they do with the paralytic? Had four friends bringing him on a mat to Jesus. Same idea. And now here, one who is deaf and had a speech impediment. If you look at that word speech impediment, that literally means speaking with difficulty. That's what that word means. Similar to the paralytic, understand the great stigma that's involved here. This is important, friends. There's a great stigma that would have gone with this condition. This is not just a man with a really bad cold or a really rough bout of pneumonia. That's not what we're talking about. Jesus is encountering individuals with, mark it, a permanent condition, disabilities. This man in the Decapolis was deaf and unable to speak well. And back then, there would have been an immediate stigma of being mentally handicapped. Just so clear. The more you read, the more you understand, he would have been branded right away, mentally handicapped. They would have heard him fumbling with his words, right? Struggling. And that would have been it. He has a problem. And they would have declared him an outcast. Yet, as we've also seen time and again in Mark, Christ doesn't bow to social stigmas. Have we not seen that? In fact, he often seems to do what? He swims directly against them. Who dares approach the unclean leper? Jesus does. The Gentile woman, Jesus does. Who dines with tax collectors? Who dares to give those sinners time? Jesus does. Paralytic, leprous, unclean, deaf, blind, mute. It's no matter to Jesus what they are. No matter. Jesus approaches, and what's the request? Look at verse 32. They begged him to lay his hand on him. Same idea there with begging. We've talked about this with Jairus before. A woman that's come to him, same plea. Do you see that heart attitude before Jesus? Begging, pleading, desperation. The request is made, and we know what happens next. He will be healed. He will be healed. However, this is not a general healing, not a summary account. Remember, we talked about that off the top. Not a summary account. There's more here. Let's zero right in on verse 33. And taking him aside from the crowd, privately, he put his fingers into his ears and after spitting, touched his tongue. And this simple verse demonstrates just how intimate Jesus' care is. And he does it in three ways. And friends, listen, these are three ways you will not see a charlatan faith healer do it. This is three very specific ways from an intimate Christ. This is not theatrical stuff. This is Christ who cares. Number one, Jesus takes this man aside from the crowd privately. Do you see that? That's a one-on-one aside. That's the picture of intimate care. It's exactly the same thing, right? The doctor does when you go back into the room. You're not just in the waiting area anymore. You go where? One-on-one with the doctor in the room. That's what this kind of care is. Jesus has certainly healed publicly before, right? Synagogue healings. In fact, he burst on the scene publicly healing. He's done that. And that was, again, remember, establishing who he was. But here, Jesus knows the stigmas, knows the condition, and now it's just him and this man. There's no need for public comment here, just private compassion. That's the first thing in this verse 2. Keep reading. Jesus puts his fingers into his ears. I don't know about any of you. I don't like anyone putting their fingers in my ears. That is for sure, right? And why? Because it's a very invasive thing, is it not? And kids do that and do all kinds of crazy things. No one likes that because it's invasive and it's uncomfortable. But it is intimate. However, Jesus does it here, and to this deaf man that cannot hear, this is an act of sign language. Remember, this man is deaf and has trouble speaking, so he's meeting him in a very unique, tender way. If you will, Jesus is communicating exactly with the way this man needs to receive it. Very tender, very tender. And what may appear on the surface as a strange, invasive act, it's actually an act of deep care and intimacy. Do you see that? This is the stuff of parents with the sick child, doing things, cleaning things up, doing all of those things because they love them. Things people can't imagine that they do. But they do that. They go into those places because they love them. It's the same here. Think about Helen Keller. Many of you know her, blind and deaf, couldn't speak. Anne Sullivan's breakthrough with Helen Keller was this invasive intimacy. Many of you know it, taking her hand, right? Putting her hand on her face, writing on her hand. Without that invasive intimacy, there would be no breakthrough with Helen Keller. The same here with Jesus. Going into these places intimately with this man because it's what he needed. Thirdly, keep reading, Jesus spits and touches his tongue. Another sign act, right? This, again, the sign language from Jesus. Another sign act meant to communicate to the man that Jesus would not only heal him, but mark that Jesus was there. I mean, what more intimate act than that binding, that saliva together, touching the tongue? Really sealing the deal here, Jesus is, that he is with him and he will heal him. Of course, it is another invasive act and seemingly taboo. I mean, saliva contact. However, remember, the man is deaf, and Jesus meets him where he's at. In his ability, or inability in this case, to hear, Jesus is there, and Jesus communicates through signs. Fingers in the air, a touch of the tongue, pointing to the healing that's about to happen. Jesus drawing close to exactly what this man is in his deaf and mute condition. And church, grab the picture as you look at that verse. This is your intimate Christ. Your intimate Christ. This is what sets him apart. It always has. As others, as the world, as the false deities of other religions seem further and further away, right? the distance and personal nature, Christ draws close right into our space to meet us, no matter our condition, no matter what you are before others, before those around you, and no matter what stigmas the world wants to place on you, Christ draws close to you where you are. That is your intimate Christ. And he continues, our third point, Christ draws us close to who he is. Christ draws close to where we are, what we are. Our third point, Christ draws us close to who he is. Christ has drawn the deaf man aside. He's placed his fingers in his ears. He has touched his tongue. And now this, look at verse 34 with me. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, Ephphatha, that is, be opened. Great visuals here in this verse. Look at it. Jesus looks up to heaven. This is something we've seen Jesus do before, right? That physical looking up. Just a chapter ago, in fact, in Mark 6, before feeding the 5,000, verse 41 says, he took the loaves and the fish and did what? Looked up to heaven and said a blessing. This is something we've seen Jesus not just do a chapter ago, but we've seen him do elsewhere. What about John 11? Lazarus, right, being called out of the tomb, the dead Lazarus being called out of the tomb. What does Jesus do? The stone is moved away and Jesus looks up to heaven. And this looking up to heaven is nowhere more demonstrated later in that same Gospel of John than John 17. John 17, after the upper room discourse, those rich chapters, John 13 to 16, rich, rich teaching from Jesus. Then he turns and he prays. All of chapter 17 is Christ's prayer to the Father. And then in John 17, 1, this is how it's introduced. When Jesus had spoken these words, so all chapter 13 to 16, when he'd spoken these words, verse 1 says, he lifted up his eyes to heaven. And then he prays. So not just the head raised, but the words spoken. The insight from Christ, turning to the Father, not only affirming Christ's unity and his identity with the Father, but more in that upper room prayer, drawing those disciples close to him. That's the purpose of the prayer, and we don't have the time to get into that this morning. We've looked at John 17 before, but the idea that he's grabbing them, taking them with him, that unity, that oneness in him. But listen to one verse in that prayer, John 17, verse 11. Listen carefully. Keep them, the disciples, in your name, which you have given me, that they may be one, even as we are one. You hear very carefully, Jesus reaching up, right? Reaching up to heaven with those disciples held tight in unity, drawn to him. And it is the exact same sense here in Mark as Jesus again looks up on behalf of this man. And how is that confirmed in our passage? Look at what happens next. Confirmed by the sigh. Do you see that in verse 34? In fact, that's just not an everyday word. We think about how we sigh. Now that is actually a deep groan is what that is. That's actually, mark this, a visual. It's a sigh that's not just heard. It's a sigh that's seen. That's what that sigh is. In fact, that word points to an internal, inexpressible emotion. And see this as we continue to round out the picture as he ministers to this deaf man who cannot hear. Jesus gives him and meets him himself. And then the command, look at it, Ephphatha, that is Aramaic actually, and it's the language of the day. We've talked about that before, and what does it mean? Mark tells us, remember, for a Gentile audience that needs to know, he just puts the explanation right beside it. What is it? Be opened. Be open. Mark, just so good with these details, right, knows his audience, gives us all the little details. The command for the impossible. Imagine that to the deaf man, his ears, difficulty speaking, his mouth, the impossibility of that command, be opened. Be opened, he says. Ears and mouth, be opened. We have ample evidence in Mark now, friends, to know that there is only one that can do that. There's only one that can say those audacious words. And here Jesus draws this man right close to him to show him who he is. Look at verse 35. And his ears were opened, his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. Great physical picture here. His ears were divinely opened. Now he can hear. And his tongue released. You look at that expression, his tongue released. That actually means literally the chain of his tongue was broken. That's what it actually reads in the original language. The bondage of his tongue, that's a great picture. There's a chain on his tongue preventing him from talking normally. His ears with a blockage and now speaking plainly. Clear, clear speech. What a picture that is from impediments, blockages, inability to liberation, clarity, and market absolute ability because of Christ. In Christ, as this man draws near. Not just a great physical picture, friends, but a spiritual reality as well. This is exactly the picture that Paul imparts in Galatians 5:1. He says this, Christ has set us free. Those simple words. If you're a Christian here, spiritually, Christ has set you free. You used to be in bondage and chains, but now you're free. Great picture. This man, not just with a new lease on life, but a new look at the one who gives life. Sign language no longer needed. His words are plain. And imagine this. His words, this deaf man's words, are being heard like they've never been heard before. Isn't that a great picture? You can just imagine him speaking and people understand clearly what he's saying. Isn't that a picture for us, friends? How many of us liberated in Christ, fumbling around before in bondage and chains, we didn't know what we were saying and what we were doing. Christ came and he broke those chains. And he gave you clarity and direction in your life that you've never had before. And that's the exact same picture that we have here. Christ sets free. And like he would be, we would imagine, like we were as Christians, right? Ready to be unleashed, new Christians, set free, liberated, clear, raring to go, raring to proclaim. But there is one problem, and it's the same problem we've seen before in Mark. This man feels ready to proclaim Jesus, right? Feeling that strong emotion, he feels ready to proclaim Christ. But Jesus has other ideas, and it's our last point. Christ draws us close even when we are not ready. Christ has done a lot of drawing and calling here. But look what he does, verses 36, 37. He draws us close even when we are not ready. Look at verse 36 with me. And Jesus charged them to tell no one. But the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. Note the they there, so there is presumably a crowd around this man. So there's a day, there's a little crowd that's gathered, and you can imagine, and friends, we would understand there's a lot of excitement. You mean this guy's talking now? You mean this guy can hear me? I got to tell somebody about that. But Jesus gives the command, and we've seen it before, the command to keep quiet. Keep quiet. Jesus has commanded everyone. We've seen this, friends, in Mark, from demons and the leper in chapter 1. Right through to his own disciples, Peter, James, and John, remember the healing of Jairus' daughter, right up to them, he's told all of them, keep quiet. Of course, looked at the reasons for this common theme in Mark, it just seems to be a theme that pops up over and over again, the command to silence from Jesus. And we boil it down to really two things as we recap them. Number one is movement. Remember, we've seen how frenzied news can spread in a frenzy. And when it does that, it impedes the work of Christ. Remember this from the leper in chapter 1. Listen to this in verse 45. After he told him not to spread it, to go to the priest and show himself. Listen to this in verse 45. The leper is healed. But he, the leper, went out and began to talk freely about it and to spread the news. And what's the result of that? Disobedience. So that Jesus could no longer openly enter a town, but was out in desolate places, and people were coming to him from every quarter. Movement restricted. I mean, there are many things that we can say good and right, and we'll get to this about can you cut the leper slack and cut people slack that want to, but one of them, the movement of Christ, the ministry of Christ, and we've seen this before, the leper is one, impeded by disobedience. So that's one. Number two, why the command to silence? And this is the big one, and I would say it's the one in view here, understanding. Understanding. This is the idea of proclaiming before knowing. That's what's going on through this. Remember that there's two words for knowledge. We've looked at these language things throughout Mark, right? Different words for knowledge and for dog as well. But remember, knowledge has two senses. You have oida, that's that knowledge to know about something. I know about Australia, but I don't know it. I'm not Australian, I've never been there, but I know about it. And then there's gnosis, right? Prognosis, hypnosis, these deeper understandings, that's to know of something deeply. We have one word, knowledge, but in the original language, there's two. And every time you encounter someone who has this quick healing, quick interaction, the word used is that about knowledge. They only know about the healing. They only know about Jesus. We've looked at that in depth. Well, once again, it's that kind of understanding that's in view here. And how do we know that? Without that specific word, we'll look at verse 37. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, "He has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak." You may look at that verse, you may hear that and say, what's wrong with that? They seem to really nail it. It sounds good. It certainly does sound good, does it not? But I want us to pay careful attention again to the focus. Look again and let's read it slowly. Tell me where the focus is. He has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. That says a lot about what Jesus has done. Absolutely nothing about who he is. Do you see that? Lots and lots about the doing, nothing about the person. And here again, we see the same misunderstanding that seems to be plaguing the followers of Jesus in our study of Mark. The tunnel vision that can't get past this Jesus, this miracle worker, simply can't get past that, the act. Understanding of Jesus here is all about what he can do. Look at that again. He has done all things well. Isn't that amazing? That's the summary statement. He's done all things well, indeed. But that is such a one-dimensional understanding of this Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And even more, friends, we've talked about this. It's hardly the type of stuff, it's hardly the assessment that makes one ready to proclaim that Son of God. They are not ready. But yet, mark this, friends, great encouragement for us, yet Jesus still comes. Jesus still draws near. And he always does. And we've seen, and we must repeat this, it is not about our readiness. It's not about our readiness. In one sense, we will never be ready for Christ. That's precisely why he comes to us, seeks us out, draws near. We were dead in our trespasses and sins. We've been in Ephesians a lot this morning already. Ephesians 2 tells us what? Right at the beginning, we were dead in our trespasses and sins. We are not ready at all. Yet Christ comes and Christ reveals himself because we are unable to come to him. This Gentile deaf man, that Syrophoenician Gentile woman, the leper and on, unable to come to Christ. And that is precisely why God must draw near to us first. Christ draws close even when we are not ready. And as we consider not being ready, our helplessness, our need for God, we're reminded that such truths have always been in view, and this is nothing new, especially for those of us that have been saved by Jesus in this one-time transaction of salvation. We recognize, even as we did then, God's people have always been in need. We always are in a state of readiness, but readiness is different to recognition. In fact, Mark gives us a connection here. Mark links this account directly with another account in the Old Testament, and he does this very specifically. He does it through one word. Look at verse 32. He does this through one word. It describes the man as one that had a speech impediment. Do you see that? That's very similar to what the King James says. The NIV says he could hardly talk. Those are all phrases. Whatever your translation is here this morning, those are all phrases that are distilled down to one word in the Greek. It's just one. And it's only found here in the New Testament. And it's also found in one other place. In the Septuagint, some of you know what that is. That is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the very Bible that Jesus would have had. The Greek translation of the Old. And that same word that you only find right there, as you look at verse 32, you only find it in one place in the Old Testament. It's in Isaiah 35. It's a description and a passage of people liberated by God. It's actually a future prophecy in Isaiah 35 when Christ returns for good to establish his kingdom. We've talked a lot about that being the ultimate work of this king and this Son of God. Listen to Isaiah 35, 6. So this idea about Christ, future work. When Christ returns, the tongue of the mute will sing for joy. Tongue of the mute, there you go. That one word connecting the two, you would say, wow, that's an awfully far distance for a connection, but it is not strained. This is an intentional link, mark this, between two realities. One inbreaking, arriving, one first coming of Christ here. And here in Isaiah, that second coming when Christ comes again to take care of disease and sickness, all of these things we've seen, not just in a moment in the present, but once and for all. And although it was missed by so many in the first century, even today, it should never be. That ancient prophecy in Isaiah 35 makes this abundantly clear. Listen, just listen to the verses before that word. Isaiah 35, verse 1. The wilderness and the dry land shall be glad. The desert shall rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of our God. Strengthen the weak hands, make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who have an anxious heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, with the recompense of God, and he will come and save you. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. That passage, with all the hallmarks of everything that we have been learning in Mark, is it not? The call to recognize not just the work of God, right? Recognize his work, but what was more in that passage? The person of God. His might, his majesty, what he is, who he is. Same thing in Isaiah, same thing in Mark. Who Jesus is. The antidote to the weak, the anxious, the blind, the deaf, the lame, the mute. Hear it again from Isaiah 35, 4. Listen carefully, Christian. Be strong, fear not. Behold your God. Look on your God, see your God, recognize your God. That's the ancient call. Christian, that remains our call as his people today, I would say. Behold, look on God. You see that? Not the problem, not the work. God. Look on his majesty, his power, his sovereignty. But as you do, remember this, you don't do what? You don't behold God. You don't behold God. You behold your God. Your God. That pronoun, laced through all the prophets in the Old Testament, beloved, makes all the difference. He is no impersonal God out there, and you're hoping for the best. He is your God. This was the cry from an intimate God to the nation of Israel. You are mine. Baal is so impersonal. Molech, just out there. And it's the same today, is it not? All of Eastern mysticism, whatever you want, New Ageism, that out there God. The cry, Christian, from your salvation to this day that they missed over and over in Mark, wanting to divorce the person from the work. An intimate God that wants to come. And you don't behold a God. You've thrown your weight in with this God because he did a lot of things. Your stock and your security is with market Christian. Walk away today with this. Your God. Your God. He owns you. He has you. And he will never let you go. Behold your God. That God that is immense, but that is intimate, is your God. Remember, that makes all the difference as you approach your God. Father, we thank you.